I can't believe I'm doing this. I can't believe I'm sitting here at my computer, half past midnight, my fingers pecking out these terrible words on the keyboard. But insomnia is a bitch, and my therapist says this is a very healthy exercise. All I want is to get some sleep. He says that the words need to come out, that they're clogging up my insides like sludge and ancient plumbing beneath a crumbling house. Words can be poison, he says. Thoughts can be poison. It's like draining a wound, he says. But don't you have to drain a wound over and over again until it's healed? I don't think I can do this more than once. I've heard it all, the different diagnoses given to me by every doctor from one coast to another. Survivor's guilt, PTSD, schizophrenia in some rare cases. The problem isn't in what I saw, it's what I didn't say. When I was 8, I went to an all-girls summer camp in June of 1977. I was in tent 6. They called it tent number 8, but that's stupid, because we all know that no one counted the counselor's tent. I was in tent 6 with 3 other girls, or tent 7, if you read the reports. Whatever. Does that matter? We were all in the same group, the Kiowa group. Our tents were in a tight little cluster. Tiny little tents. With tiny little girls inside. There I was, until I heard the noise outside. I woke up with a start, clutching the stuffed animal that I had tried so hard to hide from the older girls, because they laughed and said toys were for babies. Mr. Beans wasn't for babies. He was my friend, but I didn't have many friends that weren't stuffed animals, so I kept him hidden in case the older girls came back. And maybe they had. That's what I thought. The rustling sounds outside the tent sounded like someone was there. My first thought was the older girls from the Arapaho group. Girls who were allowed to wear lip gloss and talked about boys and just seemed so cool, like the ladies on the covers of magazines. They had teased me earlier at dinner that night, especially about Mr. Beans, but for one hopeful moment, I thought maybe they were testing me to see if I was tough enough to be their friend, to prove I wasn't a baby. Mom says that sometimes people tease you because they like you. I wanted them to like me. I didn't wake up the other girls because I knew they would ruin the whole thing. They would probably cry and be babies. And then the older girls from the Arapaho group wouldn't be my friends. I even put Mr. Beans behind my suitcase so they wouldn't see him. I waited, but nothing happened. More rustles from outside, that was all. The tent flap opened. I looked for the faces of my new friends, but there was a man. Not any of the counselors. Someone that I had never seen before. This realization set in like a heavy stone sinking to the bottom of a black pond. I can't do this. I can't do this. But I have to drain the wound. His eyes scanned the tent. His eyes counted. 1, 2, 3, 4 little girls. His eyes stopped on me, and his eyes met mine. He then smiled. It was not a very nice smile. He then put one finger up to his lips and said, "Shh." I nodded because he was a grown-up, and my mom taught me to listen to grown-ups. He ducked out and closed the tent flap again. It was late at night, or early in the morning. I'm not sure which, because it was so dark, and it seemed like such a long time to lay there awake before I heard someone moaning in the distance. It was quiet, but not that far away. I'm told that other girls heard it too. Some girls made up stories afterwards to get attention, but not me. I never told anyone. Not until now. When the light finally started to break, I realized how badly I needed to pee. I wasn't sure if the man was still outside, but it was probably okay because it was morning and the sun was coming up over the horizon, and bad things didn't happen to little girls in the sunshine. So I poked my head out of the tent and looked around. The sky was that pale white blue color it turns just at dawn, but it still felt safe. Somehow better because the sun had risen and everything was okay. I headed down the trail towards the showers and the toilets. And that's where I saw them. At the base of a tree, slumped together like strange piles of garbage, were the corpses of three little girls. I knew their names. I still know their names, but does that matter now? Two of them were in their sleeping bags. One was just on the ground. She had her pajama top pushed up. No pajama bottoms. A strange red flashlight was near their feet. There was blood. They weren't moving. I can see them. I can still see them. I can still see them. It doesn't feel like draining the wound so much as infecting it. I don't know why, but I went right past them. I guess I knew if I went back to my tent, I would wet the bed. I'd never have any big girl friends if I did that. So I went right past the little sleeping bags and straight to the bathroom. I peed and went back to tent number 6. Tent number 7 was empty. I went back to sleep. It was the last sleep I ever had, unbroken by nightmares or screaming. I think I convinced myself the whole thing was a bad dream. There was no man. No pile of sleeping bags with dead little girls inside them. No empty tent number 7. The counselors got us up earlier than usual. We went to the Great Hall for breakfast. We went canoeing in the river. It was fun. Everything was okay. Bad dream. That was all. Buses came to take us back to the Great Hall. When we got off the bus, one of the older counselors who ran the camp told us that there was a problem with the water supply. Camp would have to be canceled for the summer. We all needed to pack our things and go home. Camp canceled. In tent number 6, the other girls whined about how it was unfair. They had sold so many cookies to get here this year, and after one stupid day it was all over. But I kept hearing the gray-faced counselor's words in my ears. Camp is canceled. Camp is canceled. I tried to nap on the bus ride home, but my seatmate kept waking me up because she said I was crying in my sleep. The bus stopped, and I got off. The troop leader said not to talk to anyone who wasn't our parents. There was lots of reporters and shouting. Mom grabbed me and cried. No more camp, she said. She threw out my sleeping bag as soon as we got home. The police came once or twice after that, but I never talked to them. Mom told them that I had been very clear, that I hadn't seen anything, that I'd slept all night. I haven't slept a full night since. Would it have helped if I had said something? If I told someone? Every time I thought about doing it, my heart plummeted into my stomach. I saw the man's face, with his finger on his lips. Usually I would throw up. So these words, the words I've never said until now, they have festered inside me like some exotic form of mental rot for all these years. I can't hold down a job for more than a few months. I take too many sick days. No husband to speak of. The night terrors took care of that. A man will only sleep in your bed so many times before the screaming and thrashing drives them away. But my new therapist, he's been so nice. He tells me whatever happened wasn't my fault, and that this will help. And I started to think that maybe it was time to tell. Time to describe the face that poked into tent number 6 that night in 1977. And then I remembered what I had blocked out. The thing my mind forced me to forget, even though I can still see the twisted, tangled little bodies underneath the tree as clear as day. My brain shattered this memory and scattered it to the wind, but it has always been there, waiting at the bottom of my gullet, forcing out vomit instead of words should I ever decide to tell. When I went to pack my bag that day, Mr. Beans was gone, and in his place was a little scrap of paper. All it said was,
never again can I bring myself to go into the woods. The events that transpired a few weeks ago caused this. Here is my story. I was never a big fan of rural areas, being born and raised into city life. But when my lifelong best friend Cody mentioned a big camping trip that he had been adamantly planning, I couldn't say no. Considering that he was my boss in the office and had given me a week off for the trip, there was no way I was getting out of it. The thoughts of sleeping in a tent surrounded by spiders and centipedes and God knows what else were enough to unnerve me. But after seeing his face light up like a little kid as he detailed his plans, I couldn't bring myself to let him down. He set us up on a 5-day hiking camping expedition through the woods a few miles outside of town. The woods intersected with our state's reservation for the Native Americans, and being one-quarter Mohawk himself, Cody genuinely wanted to check out some of the scenery that was included around the hiking area. Despite my initial hesitation, it did seem somewhat interesting, and I agreed to go with him on his little trip. Poor judgment on my part. A few weeks go by, and I find myself walking through the woods with Cody with 60 pounds of gear on my back, covered in sweat and mud and wondering what the fuck I was doing. We had stumbled into the reservation early on the second day of our trip, and it was almost as if the woodland itself had a different aura to it. A pure feeling of some kind that we both noticed. But no matter how clean the nature felt around us, I was still disgusted by all of the different insects and thorny plants that I continuously had to flick off from my clothing. After battling a horde of house cat-sized mosquitoes that was assaulting me, I asked Cody, "Hey, when are we gonna set up camp, man? Not to bitch, but my legs are getting a little tired." He consulted his map and pointed over the next hill. "There's an old burial ground over that ridge, and I thought it'd be cool to make camp there for the night," said Cody. Afraid to belittle his culture in some way, I reluctantly agreed. When we got to the burial ground, it just appeared as about a dozen raised stone and grass mounds in a small clearing. Nothing special, to say the least. We pitched a tent on the tree line around the ground, so as to not disrespect the dead, as Cody said. Unpacked and cooked some food. After eating dinner and discussing our company's upcoming financial merger, Cody grew tired and fell asleep. I powered up my phone and went to make the daily rounds of all the social media sites, my last attachment to city life that I had kept during our time in the woods. Under the large trees, I was getting no service, but as I walked towards the burial mounds, I was able to pick up a signal. As I was waiting for my emails to load up, the water I had with dinner started to catch up to me. Not wanting to urinate in the open view of the tent, I ducked around one of the mounds to relieve myself. Finally, my emails loaded, and I saw that absolutely nothing interesting had happened back home in the past 24 hours. Feeling satisfied I hadn't missed anything, I started walking back to the tent to get some rest. When I reached the tent and went to undo the zipper door, I could feel the hair on the back of my neck prick up. That ominous feeling that something was watching me hit, and I was instantly aware of how loud my heartbeat gotten. I turned my flashlight around slowly, and my beams caught a deer in the brush about 20 feet behind me. He was a pretty large buck, with a large set of antlers, one of which was broken, and an ear that seemed to have been bitten off at some point. When I saw it was just a deer, my heartbeat returned to normal, and relieved, I entered the tent to get some much-needed shut-eye. The next day, we trudged onward through the reservation lands. As much as I had hated the woods, I had to admit that the foliage was beautiful, and I'm sure any amateur photographer would have been kept busy in this setting. It wasn't until dusk that I noticed something was off. All of the birds chirping and forest noises that we had heard all day had completely disappeared. I assumed that the forest went to sleep as soon as the sun started to go down, but Cody seemed a little uneasy about the silence too. Regardless, we had set up camp, so he went to find firewood while I pitched the tent. Usually, it takes me 2 or 3 tries to get the tent set up correctly. That night was especially difficult because, once again, I had that eerie feeling that I was being watched. I wheeled around and once again see the face of the deer with the broken antler and the damaged ear peering out of the bush looking at me. Involuntary shudders crept through my body, and I got the all-around sense that something wasn't right. When I made movement to try to shoo the deer away, he simply stayed put and stared at me with those beady black eyes. In this case, though, Logic overcame my gut instinct, and I realized that the deer posed no serious risk to me, so I shrugged it off and continued setting up the tent. When Cody returned with the firewood, I told him about the encounter. His lower jaw dropped, and his face instantly put on a look of utter fear. He hurried me into the tent, closed the door, and started telling me a story about the Akwaonki, or deer men, that the Mohawks had legends about. They appeared as tall, dark, skinny men, yet could take the form of deer or other animals of the forest when need be. He described them as demons of the forest, who preyed upon unwanted visitors and invaders to the Mohawk lands. He started explaining legends of how some of the original American colonists were gruesomely murdered after clearing Mohawk forests to make their homes in the New World. At this point, my hands were shaking uncontrollably before Cody had to stop his story mid-sentence from a sudden fit of laughter. He looked at me and said, "Come on, man. I know you're afraid of the woods and all, but forest demons? Don't tell me you believe that shit." I punched his arm and called him an asshole and had no choice but to laugh at myself. Regardless, that night my dreams were plagued by shape-changing deer and wolves and bears who were waiting in the woods to murder me in some brutal, violent way. These paranoid thoughts carried over into the next day's hike, where every sound that I heard was something stalking us, waiting for an easy chance to go in for the kill. Unfortunately for me, Cody didn't notice how much his story had thrown me off, and so I still had the task of collecting firewood that night as we set up camp. I took the flashlight and set out before it got too dark. As I was about 10 minutes away from our camp, my flashlight ran across a deer's face sticking out from the foliage about 30 feet ahead of me. Sure enough, he had a broken antler and a ruined ear. So it was the same one I had seen before. His beady, almost dead eyes just stared at me like they had two nights before. Except this time, I noticed that something was really wrong with the whole picture. Then it hit me. The deer's head was almost 8 feet off the ground, and between the leaves, I saw what looked to be a long, slender black arm with sharp claws pointed directly at me. I dropped the flashlight and turned and sprinted towards the tent as fast as I'd ever ran before in my entire life, not looking behind me. I reached the camp and pushed Cody inside the tent. In my hysterics, I wasn't able to relay the full story to him, but he caught on to my fear immediately. We grabbed our camping knives, the only weapons we had brought, and sat in the tent that night, looking out the windows, vigilant for anything that would try to approach our camp. When dawn finally came, we were both awake still. By that point, he had gotten the full story, and after consulting a map, decided that we could make it to the local road and call for a ride back home before nightfall. Leaving all the non-essential items behind, we trekked the road, called a cab, and got a ride back to the lot where our cars were parked. Cody still didn't entirely believe that what I had witnessed was true, but I knew what I had seen. "Go home, get some rest. We'll meet for drinks tomorrow," he said. "We can talk about it all then." I silently nodded my agreement as he dropped me off at my house and pulled off into the night. Feeling relieved to finally be back in the city, I jogged up the stairs to the door, unlocked it, and walked into the apartment. As I set down my keys and walked to the bedroom for some well-needed rest, I noticed an odd, irony tinge hanging out in the air. The smell was weak, but certainly there. I turned on the bedroom light, and it was just sitting there on my bed staring at me, with its ruined ear and broken antler. The next day, the police told me the deer had been skinned and some sort of mask had been made of its face and left in my bedroom. No additional evidence of a break-in was found, and it was never determined how the perpetrators had gotten into my locked apartment. The police investigators tried passing it off as simply another random act of vandalism by some of the meth heads that frequented the area. According to the investigators, the weirdest part was nothing was taken from the apartment at all. In fact, the only additional clues left behind were the four long gash marks that had been cut straight across my bed.
There's always a reason.